Alright, so prayers are on page, what, 34? 34. So we'll do Refuge in Bodhicitta, and the Four Immeasurables, and the Seven Limb Prayer. I'll just give you some quick things, because I'll tell you I would explain that one too. So if you read, see the Seven Limb Prayer? Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. We just talked about what prostration is an antidote to, didn't we? Antidote to what? Pride, arrogance. Yeah, we need that. So prostrating, paying homage, showing respect is an antidote to pride and arrogance. And I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. So practicing generosity, giving, making offerings, what's that an antidote to?
Greed.
Yeah, greed's, you know, our little stinginess and wanting to hang on to things. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless times. That one might be a little bit hard to figure out. I'm going to silence myself on here. But it's a... declaring, acknowledging our negativities is sort of the first step in purification. You know, it's to show some, yes, I did this. This was wrong. Okay, so this helps us purify our body, speech, and mind is by making a declaration of our negative actions. Rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. So rejoicing is an antidote to what? This is, I'm going to make you think. This is a, pardon? Jealousy. There's my plant over there. Yes, the antidote to jealousy. So, you know, if somebody runs off with your wife or husband, rejoice. You know, if jealousy arises in the mind, you go, God, I hope he really enjoys her or him. And I just am so happy for them. That's rejoicing, and it'll be the antidote to jealousy. Of course, not easy to do, but seriously, in small ways, we can rejoice. You know, you see somebody who has a nicer car than you do, or who's nicer looking, or has more money, or whatever you consider to be, whatever causes jealousy to arise in your mind, you go, as soon as you feel the jealous mind arising, you flip it around and you go, gosh, isn't it great that, you know, he's got $10 billion and a Maserati, you know, and owns a video company making violent games and whatever. I'm just kidding. Anybody work for Epic Games here? I know some people that do. Okay. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence. So we're asking, we're beseeching the enlightened beings to stay around until the end of cyclic existence. So that creates the causes for that to happen. And it also creates the causes for us to stick around too, and until we're enlightened, and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. So that's, we're asking the Buddhas to stay around and teach. So again, it creates the causes for us to receive the teachings. And then, and I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. So I've always, everybody, you know, gets a little bit confused about dedication of merits, but supposedly, you know, like we're constantly creating, you know, we do positive things, don't we? We're not all bad. I mean, you know, we do good things for people from time to time for others. And so if we do something nice, like if you give, a morse, like one of these guys is on the exit ramp, you know, he's got a homeless sign and says, you know, please give me some money. Give me some food. Give me anything. And a lot of them are homeless people. And if we do give them something, but we don't dedicate it to, you know, the merit to the benefit of all sentient beings, then that merit will ripen in the future, but it won't ripen as a cause for us to get enlightened. It might ripen, you know, as a nice vacation or a new car or, you know, in some future lifetime. I'm being a little bit facetious, but it won't. But by dedicating whatever positive potential we create, individually and also collectively, but we're really talking about individually, to this purpose of enlightenment, it kind of gives it, it goes for that and that only, and it's protected. It's not, it cannot be destroyed by our anger and negative emotions. So it's really important. And this is something you'll see if we do these classes right. At the beginning of every class, we'll spend a moment setting our bodhicitta motivation, right? And at the end, we'll dedicate. We'll dedicate whatever positive potential we've created to the benefit of all living beings. So that's a good habit to get into in your daily practice. But then even as you go out in the world and do simple kindnesses to other beings, you know, just being aware that this is all part of your practice to get enlightened, very helpful. So let's do the, we'll do all of these prayers down to the end of the mandala. Okay, ready? I go for refuge in Tom enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha filling offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Radna Mandala Kam Niryatayami. That's a whole nother explanation, but it just basically is symbolic of being willing to offer everything in the universe for these teachings that have a chance, you know, to completely free us from suffering. All right, now let's read. What page is
141?
Okay. We're going to read Three Principles of the Path. And I think, again, we'll just read this all the way through, and then Lama Yeshe is going to give a teaching on emptiness. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll just read through all the way through 8A. We'll stop at the end of 8A. The reason to meditate on right view, we'll do that later on. Okay, so starting on page 141. I bow down to my perfect gurus, the essential meaning of the victorious one's teachings, the path praised by all the holy victors and their children, the gateway of the fortunate ones desiring liberation. This I shall try to explain as much as I can. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling, stramsara, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones. You fortunate ones, listen with a calm mind. Without the complete intention definitely to be free from circling, there is no way to pacify attachments seeking the pleasurable effects in the ocean of circling. And by craving for cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, seek renunciation. Freedom and endowments are difficult to find, and life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. By thinking over and over again that action there and effects are unbetraying, and repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence, attraction to the appearances of future lives is reversed. When, by having trained in that way, there's no arising, even for a second, of attraction to the perfections of cyclic existence, and all day and night, intention seeking liberation arises, then the thought of renunciation has been generated. Even if renunciation has been developed, if it is not possessed by the mind of enlightenment, it does not become the cause of the perfect bliss of unsurpassed enlightenment. Therefore, the wise generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. Swept away by the current of the four powerful rivers, tied by the tight bonds of karma so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping, completely developed in the total darkness of ignorance, endlessly reborn in cyclic existence, ceaselessly tormented by the three sufferings, thinking that all mothers are in such a condition, generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. In short, if like the mother whose cherished son has fallen into a pit of fire and who experiences even 1 second of his suffering as an unbearable eternity, your reflection on the suffering of all mother sentient beings has made it impossible for you to bear their suffering for even 1 second, and the wish seeking enlightenment for their sake arises without effort, then you realize the precious, precious mind of enlightenment. Now I'll read this next one. Without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you've generated renunciation, right, and the mind of enlightenment, or bodhicitta, you cannot cut the root cause of circling. Therefore, attempt the method to realize dependent arising. So, dependent arising. I'm going to write 3 things on the board, then we're going to look at Lama Yeshe's the video. Lama Yeshe's going to do most of the work as usual, but these are things that we don't ordinarily see these things in daily life. You wouldn't see this unless you stopped and thought about it. But these are pretty obvious truths. These are not hidden truths. Okay, they're a little bit hard to realize, but they call when we write down. Okay, the Dalai Lama said, if the Buddha had a slogan, if there was something, one little snippet of the Buddha's teaching that was like the most, like the this would be his slogan right here. Dependent arising. I don't know if you could say it's the most important teaching. Buddhism? Maybe it is. Dependent arising. So, what this means, what it means is that things arise or come into existence in dependence upon. Okay, so let's just think about this. Nothing exists. Remember, we talked about this early on in the class. Nothing exists independent of our mind labeling it, right? Everything exists in a interdependent nature. So everything arises or comes into existence. All impermanent things arise or come into existence in dependence upon causes and conditions. That's karma, isn't it? Everything arises, comes into existence in dependence upon causes and conditions. The law of causality. Then, everything arises or comes into existence and dependence upon its parts, right? Now, how many people can see the part? What is this? Now, can you see the parts of it? When you see the parts of it, you can't see the pennant. You can just see the parts. Now, if I took the parts of this pen and put them all over the room, you wouldn't say, well, there's the pen. You just see a bunch of parts. So everything arises or comes into existence in dependence upon parts. And everything arises, and the most subtle and the most important one, everything arises or comes into existence in dependence upon a mind that labels it, that designates it. We designate things mentally, we label things upon a base. So a mind that designates. A mind that labels, designates. All right, now, you might say, well, that's not so profound. What's that? I mean, this is pretty obvious. Everything depends upon causes and conditions, right? Everything depends upon parts. Everything depends upon a mind that labels it. So what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is, even though that's the way things do exist in a positive sense, the way we see things is completely opposite of this. We don't get this. If you see a tree, you can say, oh yeah, I can see that tree depends upon a seed and, you know, and fertilizer and moisture and sunlight and warmth, and then that seed germinates and then it grows into a tree and it has a bunch of parts. And my mind's labeling it, okay? That's how it exists. But that's exactly the opposite of how we perceive it exists. We think that tree comes from the side of the tree. We don't see that we created the tree with our mind. That tree depends upon parts, causes and conditions, parts, and a designating consciousness. But it appears to be independent, doesn't it? It appears to be completely independent of a mind designating it. So if something is independent, it can't be dependent, right? They're opposites. So, for example, how do you pronounce your name?
Nickname is Willie.
Willie? Well, how do you say it?
Willie.
Willie, okay. Well, I shouldn't have to, if he was really Willie, I shouldn't have to ask him his name. His name would just come out of him, you know? If he was truly Willie, if I was truly Don, my parents wouldn't have had to name me Don. I would have just been Don. But I'm just a label. We're all just labels. We go through life labeling our whole world. And we don't get it. We think that everything is from its own side. But in fact, no, it depends upon just the process of labeling, it depends upon its parts, and it depends upon causes and conditions. So it's really, this is the juiciest thing, this is proof of emptiness, that nothing exists independently or inherently out there objectively apart from our mind. It's impossible. How does it exist? It exists like this. So this is a positive statement about existence, but emptiness, which is the ultimate truth of reality, is a negative thing because you can't see it. What we're doing is we're stripping away our projections, and what's actually left is what's there. But we can't see it. It's a non-affirming negative. Just something to think about. But anyway, so there's a take-home message here, you know, because you don't want to leave people, you know, it's not like a useless piece of Buddhist, I don't know what to say, but, you know, just interesting, you know, kind of philosophy, or, you know, this has a lot of practical applications, because, you know, we can begin to question appearances, can't we? We can begin to question our interpretation of reality. If reality really does depend upon my mind projecting it, wow, I really like to know how this process works. I'd like to know that. So let's see what Lama Yeshe has to say. How long is this going to go?
We could do kind of the first 20 or almost 30 minutes like we have been doing, and then there'll be like a little bit of time. Okay. I'll give Brian the exact code. And towards the end, he'll kind of pause a little bit, like maybe after about 25 minutes, and he'll kind of say, now think about this. So there'll be a little bit of almost a meditation in there. Did I do the life right? Or?
You can do that meditation.
Wait, I don't know which way to do the life. All of them? All? That's too dark, right? Okay. We're not going to all fall asleep, right?
Any questions? Is that clear? No, hello. Lama was it's covering a lot of territory.
How the reasoning to say there is not a primary cause for everything. So you could go backwards to the infinite, but how the reason say there is no one primary cause? In other words, there is no God. So why is not, what is the reasoning to sustain this affirmation?
What is the reason for saying there's no primary God?
Primary cause.
God.
Well, I could say
cause.
So it would
the
be
the first cause,
an independent arising. No, so there is somewhere an independent arising. So it's not dependent; it's independent.
Yeah.
So there is some reasoning to not accept that, or
give me an example of anything that didn't have causes and conditions. I mean, I'm asking you. Can you give me an example of a first cause?
Well, the Big Bang, for example, no?
Well, there had to be something before the Big Bang.
Another one, but...
And then before that, there had to be something before that. And then before that, there had to be something before that. Otherwise, you know? So there's no first cause. Just like there's no first moment. Because the first moment of time had to be preceded by a former moment of time. So in Buddhist, you know, it's logical. It's just, you can call it Buddhist logic, but it's just logical. There's no beginning to time, because you can posit, oh, there's the first moment of time, but there had to be something before that. And then you can posit, well, God was the beginning, but who created God? I mean, did he just come from nothing? There had to be something before that. You know, God had to be here for a long time and something had to create. Did he just create himself? And it brings up a lot of questions. So, the Buddhist point of view is that there is nothing exists without previous causes and conditions. And so you can't, even God had to be created by something, you know. A former God or another God or a God before that God. So there always had to be something before that creating whatever you have, right? So all, you know, what they say in the text, they make a very important distinction between impermanent things depend upon causes and conditions. All impermanent things depend upon causes and conditions. I don't know if that answers your question, but is that right? Is that what you wanted to hear?
Well,
I'm not clear then.
Yeah.
So say it again.
So if there is independent arising.
Independent arising.
Independent arising. At the origin.
There is no independent arising. Nothing can exist independently.
God?
No. I mean, that's Buddhists would say there's no independent, self-existent God that exists, you know, independently. Has to depend upon previous causes and conditions, mm-hmm. parts, and a consciousness it designates. So he's a dependent arising too, the notion of God. But then, you know, what was there before God?
A previous moment of God.
Mm-hmm. And then what was there before that? A previous moment of God. So there's no beginning to God. I mean, you can talk about God, but it's still the same process. Mm-hmm. There's no beginning to God. And in a previous moment of God created the next moment of God, which created the next moment of God, and then maybe God created us, who knows. But, you know, there's no... Buddhism doesn't really talk about... It brings up a lot of questions about, you know, having... You know, from the Buddhist point of view, our own consciousness is the creator of our experience, not some external being, some external, you know, God figure who causes happiness and suffering and all of that. The Buddhist point of view is that karma, our own mind, plants seeds of virtue, which ripen into happiness, seeds of non-virtue that ripen into suffering. So our, in a sense, you know, you could say Buddhism, I've heard Ajahn Buddha, you know, one great Buddhist saint I listened to, he said, yeah, Buddhism has a God. It's an impersonal God. It's the, you know, it's the laws of nature. He basically said, if this happens, then that happens. If something happens, then that happens. And it's impersonal. It's not any more personal than gravity. If you do this, you get that. That's the creative force in the universe. Your own form, our mind, and the imprints that we put on our mind create our lives, create your life now, and we can shape the future. And it doesn't depend upon an external creator. You know, like I said, the Buddhist perspective is that, you know, I mean, he used this as an example. He was being a little bit facetious, but he said, you know, yeah, Buddhism believes in a God. It's an impersonal God. It's karma. He's basically saying karma is the creative force. Now, if you want to talk omnipresent consciousness, you know, the different characteristics of God that we posit, omnipresence, well, Buddhists believe that, you know, enlightened consciousness pervades the universe, so you could go on with that, because once you become enlightened, your consciousness pervades the universe. The problem that Buddhism has problems with is omnipotence. You know, like, an all-powerful God, if there were such a being, why would there be suffering? If you had all the power in the universe to do anything you wanted, would you just allow things to go on like they are with craziness and suffering? And probably not. If you're a compassionate, all-powerful being, you stop suffering. You stop it. I mean, this is the Buddhist perspective. So there couldn't be a being like that. It wouldn't be logical. So omnipresence, omnipotence, and omniscience, all-knowing, no problem with that. Because enlightened beings are omniscient. But the omnipotent part of it. So when I tell you what, I don't want to... This is about emptiness, so I don't want to get into God and, you know, in beginningless and endless mind. So do you have a question about emptiness?
Well, the question should be if there is cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect, and you say there is no beginning for this cause and effect, because it's without beginning, without end.
Right.
No, it's the concept. No, it's, it started. It's not a starting point. No, it's.
No, no. But see, this is a good point too. Though, when we see things in our bare perception, when you think about, well, there must be a cause and effect for this cell phone. You know, it has lots of causes and conditions that went into creating this cell phone. But we don't think about that when we see it. We just see a cell phone. But everything that we experience. Let me see if I can make this even more practical than, because it's getting a little bit loose here. All right, so let me get back to the example I used about the cell phone earlier in the class. All right, I said, we decided that, 15 years ago, all we would have seen was an object, right? You wouldn't have seen a cell phone because nobody knew what a cell phone was, right? This is a new concept. So the label cell phone is, something that we create with our mind based on this collection of parts, right? Dog comes in and sees it and starts chewing on it. Dog doesn't see cell phone, right? What does dog see? A toy, something to play with, something to chew on, chewable object. So the dog comes in and plays with it. Now who's right? Are we right or is the dog right? Both. They're both right. Both are valid consciousness. The dog sees it. It functions as a toy, chewable object. So it is that. But it's also a cell phone. Now how can it be both? How can it be both?
Different.
It depends upon the process of labeling for its very existence. It depends upon the process of labeling for its very existence. So everybody walks out of the room, right? Put my cell phone down there. Everybody leaves the room. Dog leaves the room. Now, where's the cell phone? Is there a cell phone? Nobody's seeing it. Where is it? Is there a cell phone that exist independent of my mind labeling it? Buddhists would say no. There is no cell phone. Now, there's a memory of a cell phone, and if you came back in and saw it, you could say, oh, there's the cell phone. But when you are not having, some sort of contact with either a concept of cell phone or a memory of the cell phone doesn't exist for you, nor the chewable object or the toy for the dog. So everything depends upon the process of labeling. So here's what's really hard to see, important for us to see, because Lama was talking about there are different ways to meditate on emptiness, and the one they say that the easiest one, although I wouldn't say any of them are easy, but the one that's the easiest one said is to meditate on the selflessness of you. And the Lama asked in that meditation, he said, how do you appear to yourself? Well, ordinarily, how we appear to ourselves is, well, I'm just me. I'm just, in my case, whatever your name is, whatever, I'm Don. So I just feel like that's who I am. Now, if we look carefully, then, this is, we talk about this in meditations on emptiness, it's not easy. It's very difficult to pick up on this sense of self until we get upset or we get emotional. Then it's pretty easy to see it. Like if you see somebody that you're really happy to see or that you're really unhappy to see, then that sense of I becomes a little bit more inflated, doesn't it? Becomes more noticed. We call it that inflated sense of I. But it's the same I, but now all of a sudden it becomes sort of, pumped up. And so Buddhists would say that the who we are is just a body and a mind together, label I. And that is it. All we are is a concept, I, dependent upon a mind and body. Okay? Now, the I that I believe in, particularly when I'm angry or experiencing some strong emotion, is way beyond a merely label I, isn't it? What happens is ignorance projects a false sense of I, okay? Like me, like the real me, I. It projects a false sense of I. It reifies this sense of I. It clings to it. We call it I-grasping ignorance. We cling to this false sense of I. We believe that's who I am. And by the way, if you get in my way, you're in trouble. And if you're somebody who likes me, you get labeled friend. You know, this false sense of I that's projected by ignorance, which has been with us since beginningless time, this false sense of I projects, projects this embellished sense of I that feels permanent, by the way. So Lama was talking about how, you know, stuff that we did in the past, we carry the memories of stuff that we've done in the past. We still think we're this bad person who did this and did that, and we still hang on to memories of past actions that we're not particularly fond of or proud of. And, you know, almost like they're stuck to us, and they're part of who we are, when they're not even happening now. You know, but they seem part of this reified false sense of I. And so, you know, so in Buddhism, this, you know, there is an I that exists, and it's a merely labeled I that depends upon mind and body. Then there's this inflated sense of I. The Tibetan term is gacha. It's the object of refutation. Okay, this false sense of I that we believe so strongly in doesn't exist at all. We fantasize. It is total fantasy. In other words, in a real sense, this false sense of I, this is Buddhist, you know, this is definitely, you know, I'm pretty sure I'm representing the truth here by Buddhist worldview. This false sense of I, we believe in from the depths of our heart and live our life, you know, trying to please this false sense of I. We call it I-grasping ignorance, self-cherishing I. We love this I. We try to take care of it. We do, you know, and it gets us into all kinds of trouble, attachment, anger, fear, jealousy. Every negative emotion that ever arises depends upon this mistaken sense of I. Now, if we could see that this, again, this false sense of I, I'm going to call it the object of refutation. It's being refuted. It's not real. So we're going to refute it. We're going to say we are empty of that false sense of I. Let me give you an example of what the experience of refutation would be. If I said that there was a tiger, everybody goes out of the room, and then I've got an audio tape player here, and I say there's a tiger in the Gompa, okay, and I'm playing tiger sounds, and everybody's outside, oh my God, there's a tiger in there, you know? But then you all come, so everybody's pretty sure there's a tiger in the Gompa, right? You've made up your mind there's a tiger, okay? Then you come in here, and you believe that there's a tiger. You believe it. But then you start looking, and you can't find it. You can't find it under the cushions. I'm talking about a big Bengal tiger. You look everywhere. You don't find it. You look everywhere. And it's important to look everywhere. But you don't find it. What could you say the room is empty of? Tiger. Something that you believed was real when you looked for it was a fantasy. It wasn't real. So, same way with the I. We believe in this I, this projected sense of I, this reified sense of I that we grasp onto. We believe in it with our heart, in our heart of hearts. But when we go and look for it, it's not findable. It's not findable in the body. You can't say, that's the eye or that's the eye. You cut my leg off, I lose my eye. Or, you know, you can't find it anywhere in the body. You can't find it in the mind. The mind is just a constant flow of thoughts and feeling and experiences. There's no point where you can say, that's the eye. It's just a label that depends upon a mind and a body. That's all we are. And so this false sense of I that this being refuted is crucial that we begin to look for that. So, now let me back up because I'm going to try to tie this into karma here in just a minute. So when we look at this cell phone, does the cell phone appear to exist from the side of the cell phone, or do you see how you create cell phone? We don't see it, do we? You don't see how your mind just created cell phone. But it did, didn't it? Didn't your mind see this collection of parts and label it cell phone? And 10 years ago, you wouldn't have seen cell phone. So you know your mind did that. Okay? So our mind is creating our reality all the time, but we don't get it. We think reality is coming from... We think that the cell phone comes from the side of the cell phone, and everybody would see it as a cell phone, even the dog. But the dog didn't see it as a cell phone. And we think reality comes from the side of the object. It exists independent of our mind labeling it. This is a crucial point. We think reality exists inherently, objectively, out there. Anybody who saw her would say she's beautiful. Anybody who saw him would say he's smart, he's beautiful. Anybody who saw this would think it's great. No, that's our own personal projection. Where did it come from? Where does our perception of yourself, your perception of yourself and your perception of your world come from? Where does it come from? Yeah, your mind is projecting it, but where's the projector? Where are the frames coming from? This is like the most important point of the whole class. Where did the frames come from? From where? From our mind. From where in our mind? Not the brain. From our consciousness. Consciousness and brain's physical matter. Consciousness is not material. It comes from our mind. Where does it come from? Where do the frames come from? From karma. From former moments of mind. Former moments of mind that are beginningless have planted seeds on our mind that force our mind to have a perception. Okay? Now, 15 years ago, you wouldn't have been able to see this as a cell phone. Now you can because things have happened and now you have the label cell phone and now you see it as cell phone, right? It's the same thing with everything in our world. You see yourself as a man, you see yourself as a woman, you have a name. Your whole reality is a projection of karma. Now let me just say this. All right. If, you know, I've tried to make this point clear. I don't know if I have, but it appears that things exist from their own side out there, like this, right? But in fact, it doesn't exist out there independent of my mind labeling it, correct? Is that true? So here's one way to work with this in a very practical way. Just imagine that there's nothing out there but a screen, like a movie theater screen, okay? And the projector is our mind. And the frames in the projector are karmic seeds planted in this life and in former lifetimes. Now, if you want to see your life as being workable, if you want to see yourself as being happy, if you want to see yourself as having, literally living in paradise, what kind of actions do you think plant the seeds for that?
Virtuous actions.
What kind of actions plant the seed for me to see a horror movie? Non-virtuous actions. The karma, that's ripening. Because there's no objective, inherently existent reality out there independent of my mind projecting it. If I want to see myself, if I want my life to go well, this is how reality is constructed. This is how reality is constructed. Reality is independent of inherent existence, is empty of inherent, we use the word emptiness. It's like the room is empty of tiger. There is no inherently existent anything out there independent of my mind. And causes and conditions, past actions, plant seeds on my mind that are forcing me to see my life as working or not working or somewhere in between. And if I want to shape the future of my life to be happy, I have to practice virtue. That's just how reality is constructed. And if I don't care what my future's like, I just go with the flow. I just let the ego run the show. Just follow the self-cherishing mind, do whatever feels good, and don't worry about anybody else but you, because you're the most important one anyway, right? I'm the center of the universe. That's what my ego is telling me. So this is really important. This is so important. And it goes back to there's no first moment of mind. There's no first moment of causality. So karma from former lifetimes is constantly ripening, giving us an experience of now, another experience of now. It's not an accident. From a Buddhist perspective, it's not an accident that you're at Kadampa Center. I'm not creating your experience of this teaching tonight. Who is? You are. Your mind is making it all up. There is no Don out here that exists independent of your mind. There's no Kadampa Center that exists independent of your mind. The only reason that you're having the vision of me and this Kadampa Center is because of seeds planted in your consciousness in the past. Maybe it was a past lifetime. Maybe it could be this lifetime. Most karmic seeds that we experience in this life were planted in former lifetimes. It is possible to plant very powerful karmic seeds, both positive and negative, that will ripen in this lifetime. It is possible. And part of the good news about karma is, well, good news, bad news. The bad news is most of the karma we create is created by what? Ignorance, selfishness, self-cherishing I. So the future doesn't look good unless we do what? Pure, number one is change. Practice virtue instead of non-virtue. And number two is purify our negative karma. And we can do that. Buddhism has some great methods to purify negative karma. There are four opponent powers. And we can talk, we'll do some practice on this next week. But the four opponent powers, the first one is to acknowledge that you've done something bad. You've been bad. You know, you did something wrong. So you acknowledge that you did something wrong. And then, you did something that was harmful to yourself or to somebody else. And then the power of reliance, where we rely on our spiritual path and the teachers and the methods that they teach us for purification and also on compassion. So the power of reliance. Then the next one is the power of the remedy. And so in this case, it might be picking up the phone and apologizing to somebody, might it? Mightn't it be? Yeah. You might have, like, this is a big deal in AA, I know. Like, if you've been supposedly in Alcoholics Anonymous, if it doesn't do more harm than good, I've heard, you would have to be careful about this. But anybody who you've done, mistreated or harmed in your life, you try to make amends. You try to make amends. So, the purification process for you may be to pick up the phone and apologize to somebody for something that you did 25 years ago, because it's still on your heart. It's still, and it will ripen in future suffering according to the laws of karma. So we have to, and so we also have prostrations, which we did earlier, is a way to purify physical negative karma. We have mantras, like the 100-syllable mantra of Vajrasattva, where we can purify body, speech, and mind. They're very powerful visualization processes. You know, Dorji Khadra, where we, you know, those of you come on New Year's Eve, where we imagine all our negative karma goes into the black sesame seeds, and we offer it to the Dorji Khadra, this fire that symbolizes a wrathful deity. So we have the remedy. And then last but not least, we promise not to do it again. Promise not to do it again. So that's another R. What's that one?
Resolve,
I like that one. Anyway, I always try to get my kids, even though when they say, I'm sorry, I won't do it again, I say, you won't do it again for how long? You won't do it. You know, actually, they say, I'm sorry. They won't even say, I won't do it again. I say, okay, you won't do it again. You're sorry, I know you're sorry, but promise me you won't do it again. And then they'll say, okay, I won't do it again. Now, for how long? 10 minutes. Okay, fine, I'll go with that. 10 minutes. So you're not telling a lie. So it's important to purify our negative karma. All right, so when you see your boss yelling at you tomorrow, how can you use this teaching to help you not create more negative karma? Yeah, you can say, this guy's empty. There's nobody out there that exists independent of me. It's like a screen. This is my karma forcing me to have this experience. This is my own former actions forcing me to see this guy yelling at me and calling me a jerk. Now, not everybody in the room is unhappy about this. There are probably some of your coworkers that are going, yeah, he deserved it. Or, you know, he's helping, you know, you to be a better employee or whatever, right? So, but for you to see that this is your own karma forcing you to have this projection of being yelled at. Now, if you want to get yelled at again, what do? Yell at him. Then you create the karma to get yelled at again. If you want to not get yelled at again, what do? You practice loving kindness and patience. You don't react. You go, thank you for the feedback. Or you just keep your mouth shut. But you don't get negative. If you get negative, you just create another round of suffering for you. You yell back at him, and then create the karma for him to yell back at you. And on and on. And there's no end. That's called samsara, by the way. That's how ignorance keeps samsara going. So isn't this cool? I think this is so cool because reality is constructed this way, that if we want to be happy, this is not about thou shalt not do, you know, the Ten Commandments like that. This is, if you want to be happy, it makes sense to be kind. It makes sense to be compassionate. It makes sense to practice to live a virtuous life. If you want to suffer, it makes sense to not care about anybody but yourself and do whatever feels good and guess and just see the result. We all have the experience of knowing that selfishness almost never leads to happiness, and selflessness often leads to a lot of joy and happiness and freedom. Just think about it. It's just very practical, but from a Buddhist point of view, this is how reality is constructed. And this is how emptiness is practical. Very, very practical. End of story. All right, so...
Don,
yes?
Could we talk about the spiritual DNA?
Not tonight. But we'll put it on the back burner. Put it on the back burner. Okay. So let's do the dedication prayers. Which are on page what?
246.
246, yeah. All right, so I'm going to say we've, listened to Lama Yeshe's teachings mindfully, and I didn't really give anybody a chance to talk much tonight, sorry. There'll be next week, by the way, we're going to do 3 meditations. We're going to do meditation on renunciation, meditation on bodhicitta, meditation on emptiness. Okay? So we'll do the three principal meditations that are required by this course. And we'll also have some time for question and answer and some things like that. So, pardon? We're going to start at 6:30. We're going to try to finish sometime between 8:30 and 9 o'clock. It might be finished earlier than 9, but definitely no later than 9. So I know people have to get home and get to sleep and stuff like that. But I'm going to say that we created, individually and collectively, we created a lot of positive merit. And so we want to dedicate this merit not only to our happiness, but to the happiness of all beings. So this merit gets protected. It doesn't get destroyed by anger or any negative emotion. And it can only ripen in the causes for us to become enlightened. So we want to dedicate like that. So we'll do this prayer by Shantideva. May all beings everywhere, plagued by the sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies were worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing. May the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth. Those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Amen. So thank you.